This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half, we'll be doing Geek Speak News. In the second half, welcome your questions with comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's music was by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thanks, Michael, for the theme. We would welcome your theme and participation in Geek Speak. We are a Creative Commons endeavor, share and share alike. My name's Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me on the Central Coast of California, I have Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, political junkie, and new father. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Last week, we hinted at the fact that we might be doing some New Year's resolution content. I achieved my last year's New Year's resolution, and this year I intend not to succeed all year, but only because I'm biting off a little bit more than I can chew this year. Last year, I did a portrait every day of the year. I succeeded at that. New person, 365 photos, 365 days, 365 people. And I still haven't put the thing up, but it was a lot of fun, and I'm really, really glad this year not to carry my camera everywhere. Of course, you're looking great today, so I'll just nice, looking really good, Miles. What's your
I feel like playing some Duran Duran.
Last year you were going to teach math every week. Didn't do so great with it. Didn't do badly, but what about this year?
This year, I got a kid. I got a newborn. So, and I would say I would promise to teach her math, but I don't know that the lessons would go over too well.
For the first year?
For the first 12 months.
This is your hand. It's gone. I mean, she doesn't even have object permanency yet, right? This does not work. I looked up the...
Yeah, my news resolution isn't geek-based. It's much more of...
I think that's
trying
fine.
To keep myself and my partner sane our daughter safe and happy.
I found a simple top 10 list. And, of course, the top one on New Year's resolutions is spend more time with family and friends. So, there you go. You're going to spend more time with your family. Fine. So, what I thought we could do is, since... And my New Year's resolution this year, I'm hoping... I haven't eaten any corn-based sugar. Help me.
High fructose
corn syrup. Thank you so much, sir. Not intentionally, at least, yet this year. No. I'm a big candy, chocolate kind of person. I've just dropped it. So I'm not doing those kind of concentrated sugars or of that sort, right? So,
yeah. Although the corn industry was trying to get it recategorized, get the FDA to let them reposition it as corn sugar.
Yeah.
Which is really curious because there's already a corn sugar out there. But and so it just becomes a more dilute more ambiguous term.
So I'm giving up sweets. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing fine on day 7.
Wait, you're giving up all sweets?
Yeah. I'm going to attempt it. That's why I'm not committed. I mean, I'm still eating breads and a lot of starches. I'm still doing that.
I feel like the last show never ended.
How so? Did I say that last year?
No. The last show as in Dr. Dawn.
Oh, yeah. It's the wrong medical show. So what are you doing this year for your New Year's resolution? I mean, you're just going to commit to family. So no technical. So we're not doing technical stuff. So what I was thought
Well, I'm going to try not to get fired at my job.
That's good. You know. So what I thought we could do for people that maybe haven't done their New Year's resolution is we could recommend two really good technical resolutions they should do. And mine's going to be make sure your data is backed up. This is a common thing people don't do, right? They've got their computer. They got important stuff on there. Just do this visualization for me for a second. You're listening to Geek Speak. You're kind of paying attention. You're kind of going, gosh, they're annoying. But in case you are hearing my voice. So think of what happens if you no longer have your computer. Just completely gone. That computer that you're using is just dead. It's a doorstop. Are you sad about it? Have you lost photos you don't have new copies of? You've lost contact information, phone numbers and stuff you don't have anymore. If the case is that that's really important to you and that would be really devastating, you have to have a good backup solution. And I really recommend getting an external hard drive and having it automatically do it for you. A lot of software comes with this kind of, when it's connected, it does a backup routine. And that's the way to go. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and the only way around that would be if you're the type of person that all you do is check your Gmail, check Facebook, do Quicken Online, you know, that type of thing.
Maybe your data doesn't need to be
backed up. Maybe you're okay. Maybe that was the idea behind that web OS, you know, having just a browser as your operating system, as it were.
And, you know, lots of times when we talk about backups, we also then talk about, well, if you had an off-site backup, you know, if your house burns down, then your hard drive gets burned and your computer gets burned and you don't have your hard drive. Yeah, that is a horrible tragedy, and hopefully that won't happen to you. But what will happen to you is your hard drive will die. Like, that's an absolute.
Right.
You know, your house might not burn down. That's a tragedy. A hard drive breaking is not a tragedy. It's a certainty. So just assume that your computer's hard drive will fail. Do you have a second data copy?
Right.
You always want two copies of your data, no matter what.
And how far?
It's not hard to do.
Well, it's also, well, it takes some money.
It does.
You need to buy an extra.
You need $100.
Extra hard drive, something like that. But also something to keep in mind is how current do you need this done? If you have a bunch of photos, but you don't really update that photo library very often,
right?
You know, then once a week, once a month backup would be totally sufficient.
Right. So real simple concept, have two copies of your data. Don't have two copies on the same computer. That doesn't actually work. You need two copies on two different locations, two physical objects you move from each other.
Actually, you know what? I need to amend that statement I just made. I just realized that I made a really bonehead comment there.
It's never happened before in Geeks.
Yeah, it never happened. The backup once a week, once a month, horrible, horrible advice.
Oh, yeah?
You should always get backup software that does an incremental backup
just
every day.
Time, yeah.
And if you're not changing anything, good. Then the backup doesn't have to do anything. But
now,
always have it set up to do that backup constantly.
If you're on a current OS, well, at least Macintosh OS, you get an external hard drive, you plug it in, it says, do you want to use this thing as Time Machine? You say yes. And then as long as you have that plugged in, just you don't have to think about it anymore. It's done. It's easy. That's one way to do it. And I'm sure there's Windows solutions as well. Okay,
yeah,
Miles.
Is a Windows backup, you know, with the newer
Miles,
Windows
do you have a technical recommendation for people for their New Year's resolution?
Technical recommendation. Learn how to program.
That's a big one. That's hard.
On the contrary. I'm thinking more along the lines of, get yourself some web space. Like, figure out some provider doesn't do anything fancy. They just say, I want to make a web page and just have some static web pages up there. And, you know, go ahead and use a WYSIWYG. You're just starting out or, you know, something like that. And then just play around with JavaScript. Just a little basic JavaScript. Like, what happens if I have something dance around? Like, make a Christmas card. Or, okay, it's a little late for Christmas, but make an Easter card. Valentine's Day card or an Easter card for a family member. And so you can put that up there and then point your friends to, hey, check this out.
You have a lot of faith in the obstacle, the overcoming the obstacle of putting up a web page. I mean, that's actually
I realize it is, and but I'm not talking about make a whole site. Like make a Easter card.
All right,
where the sole purpose of it is you put something up there, and then you have like you know the Easter bunny flipping around. You know that type of thing.
I think maybe we should do a class where you teach people how to do that because I mean it's a bit of skill. I do a 2-week workshop on technology every year for the program I help manage at UCSC, and that getting that done is a day of someone helping because you have to get accounts working, you have to get
I smell
some
a blog
editor.
Post.
What's that?
I smell a blog post.
I probably have it posted somewhere already. Okay, well, fine. Learn how to program. I love it. Learn how to put up a web page.
Yeah, just the basics. I'm not talking about rewriting Windows. I'm not talking about making your own web browser. I'm talking about just do a little logic, a little like, if this is true, do that.
All right. So my recommendation to you is make sure you have a backup solution. If you don't have a backup solution, get one going now because your hard drive will fail or get very zen and just not care about the computer.
Okay. I got a better one that's better than programming. I realized, you convinced me programming's too much.
All right. What do you got then?
For someone just starting off, upgrade your RAM.
Oh, upgrade your computer with RAM.
Yeah. Your computer may be old, whatever. Do a Google search. find your model computer mm-hmm. if you have like an old Dell or something like that, or if you have a
you really just put in Google RAM and then your computer name, whatever the description is, especially if it's got a model on the back of it.
Right. And you know, or if you made your own computer, just like, you know, mm-hmm. look and try. And if you don't, you can go to some computer shop and they'll tell you what type of RAM you have and help you out there. And max it out. Like, chances are, if you have an older computer, the amount that it would cost to get the RAM that would fill up that computer, like, bring you up to,
50
you know,
bucks.
Yeah, bring you up to 2 gigs or 4 gigs, something like that. Totally, totally within your means. And if you're one of those folks that's on 256 megs of RAM or 512 megs of RAM, which there are a huge number of you
Seriously?
Out there, and you may not, oh, yeah.
Wow.
If you max out that RAM, you will feel like you have a new computer.
Absolutely. And it's a cheap investment. Now, if you already have 4 gigs of RAM, most likely don't do anything. Most likely you don't have a 64 bit operating
system. Right. If you have XP, then getting that much won't.
All right.
Won't
well,
help
we could start doing geek news, but let me just make one more suggestion. And this has to do with my disaster of having the GeekSpeak server cracked. What happened when when our GeekSpeak server got cracked by someone setting the root password to password 123. Was all of a sudden I couldn't trust anything that was on that machine. And one of the things that goes through the machine is my personal email and the Geek's email. And though I was pretty sure I never emailed a password to myself, sometimes a web service will send you the password, like for a light password. They'll actually send you the password as an email reminder. They don't actually encrypt it. And sometimes I wasn't aware of that and would use a password that was important to me. And last year I was using shared passwords for unimportant things. Like every time a new service comes online, every single one, I sign up for it as soon as I possibly can, right? So that's why my Twitter handle is Lyle, right? Because I was signed up with Twitter in the first, 7,000 people or whatever. So because of that, I have a lot of services I'm not even aware I've signed up for that use this one password that I don't care about because I haven't actually associated myself with the with it. But as soon as the server was hacked, I knew that somebody out there had that password. So I attempted to try to start changing those passwords. Lots of passwords. I mean, I have lots of accounts online. I haven't mm-hmm. changed all of them. Some of them are still that same password. And now, of course, I'm keeping randomized, long string. It's really hard to manage passwords. And I know it's hard, but it is crucial that your password is at least complex, right? And that's my recommendation for you. Make your password longer. And keep in mind, it doesn't have to be complex to remember. Like people go, well, it's my dog's name, Fluffy, but the L's I changed to ones. Yeah, that's not a good password at all. A good password should be a phrase. Nowadays, it should be a phrase. Think of your aunt that you haven't, maybe you had a grand aunt that you knew as a kid. You don't know her anymore. Her name was Sophia. She had red hair. And so your password can be, my aunt Sophia has red hair, right? Mm-hmm. Something you'll totally remember. It's easy. It's a sentence. And it's extremely hard to guess that password. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically you can't guess that password. So something long you can remember is a good one. And repetitive use of the same password, not such a good idea.
Yeah, and we know that some of you are going to say, like, I'm tired of typing in these long passwords. So fine. Red Sophia.
That's even better.
And change.
Well, a space in there.
Yeah, there's a space in there. And, do some capitalization. Change one of the letters to a number, like the O and the Sophia to a zero, that type of thing. It's better if you do the longer phrase.
Another thing,
but if you're intent that you're like, I hate typing that much, you can do just a little bit.
And if it's typing because your hands move across, do red Sophia, red space Sophia, and then add 6 nines. Because counting nine out, not hard, right?
Or
add 6 periods, whatever it is. Make it longer, but the repetitive keystroke at the end of it. It's called a haystack. It's like buffering the amount of space. That makes it much more secure, easy to remember still, because it's just, Aunt Sophia. Let's say Aunt Sophia had, 7 cats, but then you just add, C 7 times for the 7 cats. You're still going to remember it, and it's not hard to type because it's just repetitive one key. As long as it's not all one character. If you get it long, it's really good. So that's our recommendations, quick recommendations of passwords. Miles, your first GeekSpeak news item 20 minutes into the show.
So, have you heard of MAME?
Yes.
MAME is the multiple arcade machine emulator. In other words, it's the ability for modern computers to be able to run Donkey Kong and similar.
Pac-Man, yeah. Asteroids, you yes. name it. Old video game, you can play it.
All of those old arcade games that run on ROM. And people
We're talking about stand-up arcade games. Any stand-up arcade game you've played, past 4 years ago can probably be played on your computer.
Right.
Go on.
And it's become a really big thing for enthusiasts. Like, I know of no geeks personally that don't know what MAME is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even those that are playing like Left 4 Dead 2 or the newest Crysis 2 or whatever. I feel like I'm totally off on games now.
That was like, yeah, like yeah, I'm like really old.
But really, Left 4 Dead 2 is?
No, it's not that bad. Left 4 Dead 2 is probably
okay. Thank
years
you.
Old.
you know, they I will say like, parents, yes, I really love playing, you know, Pac-Man every once in a while. Going back and playing Pitfall,
the game I first loved playing video games with. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that some folks have ported MAME to native client, which is the plugin engine for Google Chrome. So you're able to
cool.
play these games now in your web browser.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And without having to change all of those ROMs, though. Without
right.
having to, because people have ported Pac-Man to a web browser. Like, for example, Google did that on their homepage at one point. But that means for every single game, you have to rewrite that game. This one is the entire library of MAME titles that are out there. Or of arcade titles that are out there, you can now play them in Chrome. Now, some people have been saying that, well, aren't we going into the same position we were before, where Microsoft had ActiveX, and suddenly you have this native code running, and only one browser supports it? And, well, one, Google is more than happy for other people to use native client. But one of the issues with Internet Explorer back in the day with ActiveX was extremely insecure, unlike
right.
native client. Native client, it runs in a sandbox, has been doing very well with that. And in addition to that, Google Chrome is supporting all the other technologies that the other browsers are doing. They're just adding on native
mm-hmm.
client. So it isn't like Internet Explorer where they went, okay, we're going to have ActiveX, but we're going to let the Java support fall behind. Oh, well, we're going to have some CSS, but not the other CSS.
Well, the other problem with ActiveX, of course, is that any ActiveX components you made could only work on a Windows machine.
Right.
So you're locked in the OS. That's not the same with Chrome.
Right. And native client will work with Windows, Mac, and Linux. Although, I think it may be x86 specific.
Okay.
I need to double
hardware,
check on that.
It's an Intel
in other words,
hardware.
I don't think it would run on a G4 Mac or, you know, a MIPS processor or
so
something like that.
Explain exactly what Chrome is doing with this client.
It's taking a virtualized PC processor.
Okay.
But at the same time, what it's doing is it's doing an algorithm analysis to see, does this program try to break any bounds? It looks to see general patterns for, is it doing a buffer overflow? Is it you know, doing something weird with the array bounds? And after it does that check and puts a certain amount of controls over that process that's running, it's running at, I believe the numbers I was seeing were within 15 to 20% of a native program on their
mm-hmm.
system.
Okay, so it is a completely virtualized operating system. Yes?
No.
Okay, so
not a virtualized operating system. It's still running with the APIs of Google Chrome, but it's running with an object code that's based
upon application sandbox,
yeah.
if you will.
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying is there's
yes, it's absolutely an application sandbox.
So it doesn't necessarily have access to your file system.
No, not by default.
Okay. So it's similar to these ideas of running a virtualized machine.
It can, if you give it permission to. But yeah.
It's similar to running a virtualized machine, like a Java virtualized machine.
But it's not. A virtual machine usually implies that you have a whole separate chunk of memory carved out for it, a whole different file system carved out for it. And this is more like the protection given in Windows 7 to Internet Explorer 9, where there is a process boundary put in. So that you are not a privileged user. Actually, it's even more so than that, but so that you're not a privileged user, so you don't have access to the rest of the system, but you're still sharing the same operating system virtual memory space.
Okay.
So it's
sandbox, but potentially still could be a problem. I mean, it sounds like it's just
anything's potentially a problem. Yeah. In fact, full virtualization has had exploits.
Sure.
So
sure.
If you break out of the virtual machine
but
and then
general,
you break through the hypervisor, then you have the machine.
Right. So they're doing, but the general short end of this is that you can go and download a MAME client, if you will, run a MAME client in your browser.
A MAME ROM, yeah.
MAME ROM. Well, MAME.
The MAME client running a
MAME ROM,
yeah.
Right. Okay, that's pretty cool. So now you don't have to do a whole bunch of downloading and installing of some MAME client and get download a whole bunch of packages. But these things are still copyrighted works, right?
Yes.
So still, you're going to break the rules unless you find non-copyrighted ROMs, which
yes.
aren't really out there. Because
the MAME client is perfectly legal.
Yeah, sure. The emulator is fine.
How you get the ROMs, that's not our concern.
When we say the ROMs, the reason we call it ROM is that this is the software that used to be stored on a ROM chip, a read-only memory hardware chip. And now we emulate all this, right? So those old stand-up Pac-Man game consoles, right? If you'd open up the console, inside is a computer board, and there's a ROM, a chip that has memory in it that's a read-only. Though you can flash it and write on it again. You can pop that chip out, put a different chip in, and that same game console will play a different game.
Usually the size of the last two segments of your index finger.
No, the ROMs are bigger than that. It's about the length of your pinky.
Oh, really?
In those games, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right.
Pretty
sorry,
big.
I was...
And they have a little window on the top that you can flash ultraviolet.
That's only EEPROMs.
EEPROMs, but most of them became EEPROMs pretty quick because that way you could rewrite them and it was cheaper. So you could have an inventory. You don't have to have an inventory. You just write them on. Anyway.
So have you left everyone behind yet?
I hope so. Quick story about your Wi-Fi security. The WPA, which is the encryption protocol that's actually really strong, WPA and WPA2, wireless protection password.
Actually, those are two different specs, but yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are, and actually they're very different. But the encryption is secure, if you will. So we're talking about the WPA encryption because that's actually what everybody's moved to. I think newer routers just have WPA2.
WPA, I believe, is the envelope. I don't know if the encryption is specified
right.
that way.
Okay.
But yeah.
So one of the things that's happened for a long time is there's this WPS. Do you know about this? Do you know about WPS, Miles?
I know of many WPSs. There's the workplace shell of OS2. There's the...
which WPS it's called Wi-Fi Protected Setup. It allows your computer to interface with your... Well, it allows the router to have communication to set up WPA. So it's been hacked. You need to turn this setting off. You don't need it. You need to turn this off because it's easy now to crack a WPA Wi-Fi password, assuming that it's running WPS, which is a protocol that the router can support as well. You need to turn that router off, that protocol off. I'll have a story up on geekspeak.org about it for the technically minded folks. We won't get into it now because we are getting close to the middle of our break. But I just want to mention that you need to take your router, log into it. If you know what I'm talking about, log in your Wi-Fi router, turn off WPS, and you'll be in a safer space. Basically, the eight-digit password that's a part of the WPS protocol, the first four digits you can guess individually, then the rest of it. So you can start guessing the numbers. You get the first four, and then, of course, it's only four more that you'd have to get, right? So it's not like an eight-digit password. It's actually two four digits. And actually, the last bit is only a checksum bit. So really, it's an easy thing to 2 hours of a computer cracking, you can get WPA broken, assuming this service is on your router. So if you care about that kind of thing, it's important. I, for one, don't care what kind of Wi-Fi I'm using. I always use secure protocols on top of the Wi-Fi because I don't trust that a Wi-Fi access point is actually the Wi-Fi access point I think it is. And that's, do you know what I'm talking about, Miles?
Yeah, I, for one, welcome our Wi-Fi WPS hacking overlords.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Hey, this is GeekSpeak, and GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruiseio.com. I wanted to also mention that you're listening to GeekSpeak on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again in just a second. With me in the air room is Mr. Miles Elam, and I'm Lyle Troxell. Rick is waiting by the phones, and again, the phone number, 800-655-5877. Miles, the first geek bit, sir? You got one?
Sure. Did you know that the person who came up with what was later known as the Big Bang Theory was a Catholic priest?
Did not know that.
A Belgian by the name of Monsignor Georges Henri Joseph Edouard Lemaître.
How did he come up with it?
Was he an astronomer? Well, this was, he made the first estimation of what is now known as the Hubble constant, mm-hmm. but looking at the expansion of the universe and noticing that it was uniformly expanding and...
Revert that back, you get to a point.
Right.
Very cool. I'm going to do a dedication for Geek Speak today. A dear friend of my family passed away, Joseph Hudgens. He taught me how to tell stories and definitely helped me be verbose, if you will, which I think has led to success in Geek Speak. So that's how I'm tying it into technology. It's a so to Joseph, thank you so much for everything you did in my life, and I'll miss you dearly.
How to be verbose?
Yeah, you don't think I am?
Well, I think you are, but I don't think it's a virtue.
And Miles Mikes goes down. We're taking calls and questions and comments about technology. 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. Let's go ahead and wait for do one news story while we're waiting for calls.
Yeah, speaking of breaking things. Well, let's talk a little bit about copyright. As many of you, well, may not know or would know if you listen to Geek Speak, copyright was only for a limited time, only for, let's see, what was it, 27 years, something like that, prior to 1978, and that's when things changed. I guess it was longer than that, but much the same. Anyway, 34 years, I guess it might have been what it was. Anyway, but the point was that what if copyright law had not been retroactively extended over and over again every 20 years since 1978.
Right. One of the fundamental reasons for copyright is to support new works being created. Mm-hmm. You give a limited right to copy it and to distribute it for a certain period of time for the creator or the person that initiated it, and with that they can theoretically make money, and no one else has the rights. So it's to help them continue making new works. That's the general concept. It helps a society by compensating for the people that spend time making new creative works.
Right.
Really great idea. And the idea would that it would terminate at some point, and therefore that would be the window of time you had that right, and then the right would go away, and then that work would be owned by everybody. Just like, by default, anything created, you'd think theoretically would be owned by the society that it emerged from, right?
Right. It was at that time when it changed from saying you had to put a little copyright symbol next to something to say this is something I want protected. Nowadays, if you write something on a napkin, it's immediately copywritten.
Right.
And I just looked it up. Maximum copyright was 56 years, so an initial term of 28 years, and you could renew it for another 28 years. But let's say that someone just went for the initial 28 years and didn't renew. So what would come out of copyright? I'm not talking about the things like Goofy or Mickey Mouse. I mean, that was something that would have gone out of copyright in 1976, 1978, somewhere around there. And one of the reasons why copyright was extended was to keep Mickey Mouse from going to the public domain. But so starting from this time period, we would have seen To Catch a Thief, Alfred Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief, mm-hmm. in the public domain, the song Tutti Frutti, Walt Disney's Lady and the Tramp.
Would still be in public domain.
Would have just gone into public domain. Rudolph Fleisch, Why Johnny Can't Read and What You Can Do About It. The 7-Year Itch with Marilyn Monroe. James Dean's Rebel Without a Cause. Or rather, James Dean starring. It just kind of gives you a thought of, prior to 1978, that's the length of time we would take before we started seeing these works that were part of our cultural history come into the public domain for everyone to use and enjoy.
Right.
And that abruptly stopped in 1978.
One of the biggest reasons I dislike the idea of that perpetual copyright is that it used to be that
it's not perpetual.
Okay.
Because the Supreme Court has said it's not perpetual. They did put Congress did put an end date on
it. Well, let me put it this way.
They just retroactively extended every 20 years when that date comes close.
It's perpetual. I mean, the basic problem with that is that in one person's lifetime, a copyrighted work never becomes public.
Right. Someone could have been born after Mickey Mouse was created and put under copyright, lived a long,
full happy life,
meeting or exceeding the average lifespan of a human being, and pass away without ever seeing that work in public domain.
Which means that your cultural identity of who you are in society, if you will, where you grow up, those icons, those things that make up your identity, never are actually truly yours.
And if you're on media that cannot be saved or does not have a longevity of that period of time, it means that you lose it forever. There are many things that were filmed in the 40s and 50s that have now deteriorated.
Right.
And even after their copyright has expired, assuming that copyright was never extended again, if their copyright expired, they would have deteriorated to the point where we couldn't ever have them.
Right. Well, let's be, I think we're very successful with that story. Let's be totally unsuccessful in Ed's question. Ed from Santa Cruz has hung up the phone, which is great because we didn't know the answer. I'm so sorry. Sorry, Ed, please do call back if you can.
So pessimistic.
It was a Windows 7 antivirus question. Yeah, anything? Nothing?
I might have been able to handle something.
And Brian's off, too. We might have trouble with phones today. Let's see if we get anything, any success in the system. I think we're actually changing over to a new phone system next week, right? Miles, another news story, sir?
Sure. One thing that's come up in many years, speaking of copyright, is that people have been held accountable for downloading, or what the industry likes calling pirating, software. And or pirating music, I should say. Music in movies. And so what would be the damages to downloading a, let's say, let's go back to software, a computer program.
Well, why don't we do movies?
No, I'll just do a computer program.
Okay. I'm gonna download and steal Photoshop.
Yes.
Okay.
You're going to download Photoshop from some site. And
from Adobe.com. They let you download. Then I'm going to crack it and not pay for it. Okay, go on.
Okay.
And it's probably like a $400 application.
Yes. And, or more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you take that software and then it gets redistributed to someone else who distributes it to someone else. So far, what's been happening is they've been holding that first person accountable for how many copies have gone out.
Oh, interesting.
And
so if I buy Adobe's software, figure out how to crack it, then upload it, and then somebody else downloads it, that person's responsible for all the ones
that
copy. If
you distribute that cracked copy, yeah.
I kind of get that idea.
And so one particular person, it wasn't for Photoshop specifically, was held to a verdict of $1,370,590, very much more than the cost of the actual license of that computer program, or the immediate registration thereof. A judge has struck this down, a district judge in Massachusetts, saying that the verdict, he's reduced the penalty down to $4,200, unless the plaintiff seeks a new trial, which they probably will. And the idea being that you are limited by the actual cost of the license fee of the software that you downloaded yourself. In other words, you are not responsible for the criminal actions of the other people that also downloaded or have a copy of it. You are responsible for yours and, you know, contributory copyright infringement.
I don't know if I agree with that.
There's contributory copyright infringement as well, but the actual copyright infringement is still. That's okay. The main.
But if I'm then selling, if I go off to 10 people and sell to 10 people, I should be responsible for the loss for all 10 of those. But what you're saying is
sold it, yeah. That's and
if
that's
someone
a whole
downloaded
other,
it from me right. And then they download and then 50 people download it from that person, why would I be responsible for any of that, really, is what you're saying.
Right. They are responsible for their act.
Yeah.
And for you putting it available and for your act of getting it, that's what you're responsible for, but not each individual act that someone did, probably without your volition.
Sure.
Because okay, you had it on peer-to-peer system. You have no idea how many people were connecting to you.
Right.
And so it seems like if you have a piece of software that's worth $400 and you get fined $4,000,
right,
that seems like an effective deterrent.
Yeah.
And it seems fairly fair as well.
Yeah, I like that. Well, thank you very much for that story. How high is this court? Is it going to be overturned by another court?
It's the District Court of Massachusetts.
The District Court. That's good. From Santa
Cruz. It's not a federal district, state district, but yeah.
From Santa Cruz, Uday, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'm calling from a cell phone, so just in case if my voice is cracking or other things, I hope you understand.
Sounds good.
I had a question. I kind of log in, just listen to you guys from time to time, so I really don't know if you've already covered up this information, but this is something that's been bothering me, and I was hoping to kind of get your opinion on that. It's to do with cookies, right? Tracking cookies. I mean, I can't open a web page without the cookies, basically, just not just one, but like tons of them opening up, and their information cookies and tracking cookies and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using Windows 7. I have an AVG, and that keeps popping up these messages that there are all these tracking cookies and all that stuff. Just last week in the Chronicle, I think there is an article that's come out with like about three or four different companies that are offering a software package now, which basically cuts off all these tracking cookies, right? And
right.
I was wondering if I was to, and they're all free packages. I was wondering if I was to do that, how would that affect my, you know, like the my search process, or how
right.
would that affect the system and all that? The strange thing is, when I go into my own system security settings and I try to kind of put it at high, guess what? All the Google and none of
right.
the browsers, they work because they
right.
just want to
because
it
they require
at the medium level.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of stuck. And with that, I have the pop-ups coming in. I have all these breakages coming
in. You know, you're in a place that a lot of people are in, Uday. I agree that a lot of people have this feeling. So I think we'll go ahead and do a little rundown on what cookies are. And does that make sense, Miles?
Sure.
Yeah.
Cookies are, in the computer terminology, a way to save state. And normal human, it's a way of just keeping track of information.
And kind of to identify who's visiting.
Well, that's what's the main reason we have it, is because when you go to a web page, it's what's called a stateless environment. In other words, you go to the page, every time you look at a web page or pull down an image or whatever, there is essentially no user identifiable information there. It's always anonymous. That's actually one of the ways that the web was able to scale so well, was able to be able to handle
most
so
of the
much
time
traffic.
When I go to a web page and Miles goes to the web page, the server doesn't know the difference between us.
Right.
Right.
And for that matter, if I go to a web page and then I hit reload, the
right.
server wouldn't know the difference.
Right. So you could hop all over the site and potentially the server wouldn't know that you're visiting multiple different pages and stuff.
Right. Now, the rub comes in when you want to log in somewhere. For example, when you're trying to get your email. Because then the server needs to know who you are from page to page. And that's where cookies come into play.
Right.
Is cookies are simply a way to say, oh, this is Miles from GeekSpeak, you know, or this is Uday. So there's a couple ways to get around this. And
let's just lay down some couple things. There's a lot more fear about cookies than is justified. Cookies are not a bad thing. From Miles and I's perspective, relax. It's like my basic default. But at the same time, there are some things that they can do that's a little creepy. But it's not what you think.
Right. It's kind of like saying that hammers are bad. It's like, no, hammers are really, really useful, and they're kind of indispensable.
Right.
But people still hit people over the head with hammers.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about,
right.
is how to avoid getting hit over the head.
So, and just a couple things about cookies that's the basic idea is really simple. The website that gives you the cookie is only giving something that it already knows about you, right? So if Miles comes and say, hey, and they say, oh, you know what? I'm going to give a unique number to this person that's saying, hey. Then every time they talk to me, I'll know it's that same person. That's really, it's that simple. So the...
I'm sorry to break in.
No, go ahead,
Uday. I would think it's as simple as that, but there is also something that is known as reporting, right? These guys are constantly reporting back on what site you've been on.
That's
and
right.
things like that. I mean, it's so crazy. Like with Google, I mean, I just have to just key in the word that I was wanting to get into. And by then, it has already figured out there's so many other things, and it pops up all these ads, which are basically just targeting that stuff that I'm looking at. I mean, it's all happening in split seconds.
Right.
So
there's
a lot more reporting that's going on from time to time. It's telling
a lot of your search stuff from Google and who you are in Google is because you're giving them they have a history on you because they've saved a cookie.
Also, what version, what browser are you using?
Yeah.
It's Windows.
What I would recommend is thinking about your web experiences. Most of the time, you're our Google member, blah, 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 and Google knows a lot about you, and that's who you are. And sometimes you might want to be very private, and then you take action to become a very private user. In the newer browsers, Chrome and Firefox, there's this private browser
and an
section,
IE9.
Which makes a completely new, fresh situation where the cookies are completely new to that environment. So instead of saying no cookies at all, which breaks all these services, you basically say, I'm going to control my identity. I'm going to have new identities whenever I want that have no association with the other identities. And that general concept is the way to manage password. I mean, manage cookie.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest as well.
Yeah. So what this means? What does it mean? In Chrome, it's called incognito.
Yes, and in Firefox, it's called privacy mode. In your case, I would actually recommend the Firefox version because with Chrome, it seems to me every time you start it, I don't know the command line version, but that ends up being a bit more complex. With Chrome, every time you start it, it starts up in regular mode and you have to explicitly open up a window in incognito. Whereas with Firefox, whenever you click on privacy mode, every time you start, it's always in the same mode.
This means
one thing that I found is, I'm sorry, but once I had downloaded Chrome and I was using Chrome instead of the Windows, and guess what? It just load up my system. I don't know what it is doing to it. And I've got a brand new laptop with, you know, like 4 gigs memory and practically not much storage in there. So it's all.
And Chrome was slowing it down?
Chrome's absolutely slowing things down.
Wait, you moved from Internet Explorer to Chrome and things slowed down?
Yeah, I did that.
There's something else going
on.
There's absolutely something else going on.
There was something else. Chrome is actually a much lighter and it's a better browser for your machine's performance than Internet Explorer. So something else happened.
Comparable IE9 depends on what you're doing, but yes, you're not going to be visibly slower with Chrome.
Right.
Unless there's something else going on with your
system.
That
again. You might want to try that again. One of the things that if you're...
Or trying the newest version of Firefox.
Yeah, you're...
Or Opera.
Right, that's true. But this is a good way to do it. The other way, if you want to get a third party software solution that erases and checks your cookies, like an antivirus software that's kind of checking them all the time, that's going to cause performance issues for you. That's going to be kind of a hit. And it's not going to be that great because, as you know, it's going to be kind of blocking things you don't really want blocked.
Yes, because right now with whatever features that are there on the Windows, like I've closed all that because I've got an AVG and I didn't want the clash between the two. And I'm finding that AVG is constantly, giving out these messages that and things like that stuff. So
I regularly ignore any kind of warnings about cookies from an antivirus place because it just doesn't know enough to know what is appropriate. Yes, I do have...
And
advertising
just kind of freak
companies
you out.
Tracking
it's,
me.
Yeah,
I do have advertising companies tracking me, but I find the antivirus place going, oh, you're being tracked, it's scary, is only there so that you feel better about the purchase of the antivirus software. That's really what I think it's for. Like the antivirus software wants to do something,
and
most of the time it doesn't find anything, so it says this.
It's like Dr. Don talking about how if you feel an ache in your leg and then you go on the internet to try to see what that might be, it could be any number of like horrible
and
things.
Pretty soon you,
that's all that pop-up is doing is saying like, it could be, there's another thing that could potentially be horrible for you. And so you get all keyed up.
And you know, the underlying creepiness of it's pretty creepy, right? You get 14 companies, they each give you a cookie, then they start passing information about, hey, this user is... has done these things, and this other person says this user has done these things. Well, let's assume that this is the same user. I mean, there's ways of doing this connection where you get a large corporation collecting a lot of data about you online, and that's a true thing that does happen. Google does that, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, you logged into your Google.
I don't know of any large company that doesn't.
No, every company's going to do that. They're going to try to collect as much data as possible with you. But I've been on the other side of that. I've tried to use that data. It's really hard to use. Like, it's not that helpful for the corporate company.
It can be. It depends on what you're doing. It depends on how the company set it up. But
they're
going to
make
is,
money on it, right? If I go and do a lot of stuff in my email that says I'm into race cars, then I'm going to see more ads about race cars other places on the net.
Right. But the bottom line, though, is to stop this from happening means that you have to take away all hammers and screwdrivers. Like you're breaking the web, as it were. And so,
but it kind of doesn't allow you to do that. And you try to do that on the security settings. Unless you don't put it on medium, some of these things...
What I mean, though, is when you put it on the a high privacy value, or rather a high security value within IE, you are effectively breaking the web. That's what the web would look like without cookies.
Right.
And things just wouldn't work. The ways that we have them right now wouldn't work.
Yeah. And keep in mind, like even saying, let's say we're not going to accept any cookies at all except for Google.com, even then they're going to track you. Right, because they still can do it. There's a way that they can serve up content on other pages. There's actually a lot of websites out there that have Google Analytics enabled, which is allows them to log.
There's also super cookies using the entity fields.
Here's the thing: you can be as good and spend as much money as you want on every software to get rid of cookies, and it's still not going to work. Right. The best way for this to happen is to make sure that you go, you know what? Now I want to be a different user. And you open up a new session, erasing all cookies. Then you can log into your Google account, right? And now the clock starts ticking. As you go around the web with that environment, you're building up cookies. Then you shut down that Cognito, that private
You shut down the window.
Down the window. You open it back up again, and you're starting over again. You have to log into Google again. But that's the way to think about it, rather than trying to, you know, just always try to be in the situation of going, well, am I okay? Then I was looking over at sports cars, and now I'm looking over at furniture. I don't really want companies to know that this is the same person. So before I go start looking at furniture stuff, I'm going to open up a new window. So you start managing and thinking about your privacy in that way, rather than trying to protect yourself completely from the internet, which isn't possible.
Right, which is all great and theoretical, but the point is that browsers are making that much easier to do now than in the past. Like I said, Firefox has a privacy mode, Chrome has incognito.
It used to be you had to like flush your cache and do all these weird things to do this. Now it really is just a setting.
Right.
And I personally love Chrome's incognito window because it's just, I do a lot of tab browsing. So what I do is I just open a new incognito window, and that environment's a fresh start, and I do whatever I want to do that I don't want connected, and then I close it up and do something else. It makes it a little less convenient, but at least I can decide when I want to share my content amongst different websites.
Great. Okay.
I hope that helps you, Dave. Good luck.
Yes, sure that does. I mean, you know, like there's so much of this confusion about what these cookies actually do, whether they're collecting private data, whether they're sending things up about everywhere you've been, and it's all that privacy stuff.
You know, We can do a little analogy that helps people really visualize what the cookie's like. Let's say you've got a small downtown downtown with like 14 stores, right? There's a grocery store and a drug store, and there's the ice cream store in the corner, right? And all these businesses, they might know each other, they might talk to each other, might not. So you go into one store, and that person said, and you, let's say it's the deli, and you grab a number on the chart to stand in line to get your sandwich, and they go, "Cool, thanks," and they give you back your receipt. And they look at you, take a mental picture of your face, and they go, "That guy ordered a ham sandwich," and they take a note on it. The next time you come in, they look at all their notes.
On the contrary,
say,
that little number that you took, that's the cookie.
Well, yeah, but then you give the cookie
then
back and erase it.
No, then they say, "What's number 35?"
Right.
And you go up, and then they
let's say they keep it long term, because that's the kind
sure,
of creepy
sure, part. Sure, sure.
That little instance right there of the number is great, and it doesn't associate with you. Now they look at you and they go, "Okay, I know this guy ordered a ham sandwich last time he was here." So Miles comes in again. The clerk recognizes his face. He looks down. "Oh, ham sandwich. Hi, you want your ham sandwich again?" That convenience is really cool, right? Because Miles can say, "Cool, yeah, I'd like my ham sandwich." Then one day he brings in a lot of people. He orders some other stuff. Whatever. That business knows what's going on with him, and he likes going there and getting food because they know more about him. That's the cookie situation we really like. We like Google memorizing the password, right? Or memorizing who you are so that you don't have to log in as much. Okay, that's a good environment. Now, let's say the deli goes and talks to the ice cream shop, and they try to figure out who Miles is. They figure out, hey, the ham sandwich guy who has this kind of ID, this is what I know about him. The trouble is it's actually a little difficult to figure out the connection without them working really well together. So now they basically have to share their list in this weird way. Every time Miles goes into the ice cream store takes a picture, walks that picture over to the deli. The deli says, "Ooh, that looks like it matches up," and sends back. It's like a complicated setup, but they can do it where now the ice cream store and the deli knows that the same person is the same person. Instead, before going to the ice cream store, Miles could make a new face happen. All of a sudden, poof, he has a new face. Now there's no way for them to connect it. And that's the incognito window. You decide when to make your new identity, basically.
Right. And you can still do the receipt, you can still get the ticket, but you have a new face and they can't remember that you had a ham sandwich the last time you came into the shop.
Right. So anyway, there you go. There's a little bit of visualization for you. Thank you so much, Uday, for the call. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
All right. Take care.
It is a hard problem, and at the same time, don't panic. You're probably under greater threat going to Facebook, and the fact that you're entering all of your personal data into this huge database for that one company.
That's pretty bad.
And clicking on the various ads that are on there that shares your information with those companies.
You know, the Facebook thing is great. Remember how you used to ask, "What's your mom's maiden name?" Yeah. One of my family members, my mother, tagged on Facebook, is on Facebook, and she has her maiden name up there. It's like, talk about simple. Like, if anybody asks what my mom's maiden name is, that is not security. That's just interesting information, maybe.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, that's pretty. Facebook's much worse.
So if you're willing to use Facebook, cookies are the least of your worries.
Dell from Monroe's Peninsula, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, how you doing? You haven't made any comments about Linux in the last little while, and I guess a specific question is, do you think you're giving anything up at all when you use Linux? I've as opposed to, you know, the any of the Windows or Mac operating systems
Certainly, every operating system has trade-offs. If you're using OS X, then you switch over to Windows, you're losing a great user interface.
Yeah, they
also specifically, I guess what I'm asking is, what are you giving up if you use a distribution like Ubuntu over Windows or one of the Apple?
Right. So for my home computers, I have two, you know, PCs, if you will, my son's PC and my PC, and both of them use Ubuntu Linux only because it's free and it's really much more secure and kind of awesome. There's a lot of really wonderful free apps that are easy to download and install. I highly recommend Ubuntu. I use my Macintosh and wouldn't give up some of the applications. One of the applications is an Adobe product called Lightroom. They don't offer it on Ubuntu, and I use it all the time for my 200,000 photos or so, right? So that application traps me, if you will, in Macintosh environment. But I actually think of it that way. I think of why I'm running Mac OS license is because there's software out there that I want that only runs on Mac or Windows. But
right. And then there's the hardware. A lot of times people will make a scanner that only works in Windows.
But that's less common in some sense than Linux. Lots of the stuff is compatible with Linux.
No, there's a lot of stuff that's still the Windows, not even like OS X compatible.
So if you have no restrictions in your working environment on your computer, you don't have anything that locks you into one of those OSs, use Ubuntu. It's awesome. It's free. And it's really quite good. I wouldn't use the most recent one. It's got the KDE, the environment's a little different, but we're running out of time. I can't get into that, I don't think. Miles, what's the Ubuntu that you currently like? Do you know?
Oh, I'm using it mostly as a server OS at this point.
Okay, so it doesn't
Ubuntu
matter.
Server.
Well, and probably most people want to use the LS, you know, like versions.
Right.
Without having any problems. I guess the newer 12 is going to be available soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, actually, because it's the last update broke some stuff.
But it's sort of back to the same, you know, where most people that are just using a browser and maybe an email client.
Stay with it.
Probably no reason, right?
There's no reason to move.
In fact, you just get rid of all your virus problems if you go to Ubuntu, right? Right off the bat. No more viruses. Yay! In some sense. Thank you so much for the call, Dell.
Well, thank you.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Family Night is offered by the Monterey Recreation and Community Service Department on Monday through Thursday evenings from 5 to 8:45 p.m. at four different community centers. Family Night is a drop-in program for local teens and their families featuring billiards, ping pong, foosball, video games, and computer games. For program locations, call 646-6556. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. You've been listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. Answering the phones is Rick Philman. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. And also in the air with me is Miles Elam. And Miles, you got one more quick news story?
Ooh, a quick one. Well, since we've been talking about SOPA, SOPA is not dead. People are still trying to resurrect
it. It was dead.
Yes. And to give you an idea of how big a deal this is, Google, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, and others are contemplating a nuclear option. In other words, planning on going black as a sign of protest to show you what your experience will be like on the internet.
I hope they do.
If SOPA starts getting closer to ratification.
We talk about it a lot. Go to AmericanCensorship.org to learn about SOPA. For GeekSpeak and for KOSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers Car Talk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.